ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I just need to make a phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been Pauline Hanson's week. It began with a poll showing her as the nation's preferred Prime Minister and culminated with a feisty address to the National Press Club, her first formal appearance there. Today, columnist, author and academic Waleed Ali on how one nation could win the next federal election and why it's so hard for the major parties to counter Pauline Hanson. I'm Sam Hawley on Gadigal Land in Sydney. This is ABC News Day. Waleed, Pauline Hanson, you think she can win the next federal election, that is, one nation forming a government and Hanson becoming Prime Minister. And look, we will get to the reasons why in a moment, but are you being bold or realistic?
No, I think I'm being realistic. I mean, there's a lot to do. I think it's possible.
Yeah.
But that's a significant thing to say. So let me be clear. If I had to put a number on it, I would say, I don't know, maybe a 15% chance.
Yeah.
This is just a gut feel. The point about that is not that it's an enormous chance. The point is that a couple of weeks ago, I would have thought it was 0% chance. So something very significant has shifted. It is now possible in a way that it just wasn't before, and there were no signs really it could be possible. And frankly, I think you're seeing that now in the way in which the government is posturing. Pauline Hanson, we saw at the National Press Club this week, that was, in a sense, the symbol that crowned the moment when she became the unofficial opposition leader.
Immigration or immigration policy has our country in the state of crisis. At the centre of this crisis is the utterly flawed policy of multiculturalism, the hoax of global warming, which is now climate change. It has produced an increase in energy costs, which has taken Australia into energy poverty. This transgender movement is a militant force right throughout society and must be confronted. If we want a secure and peaceful world, radical Islam must be destroyed.
Let's unpack that a bit more and what's unfolding. This press club address this week, you know, after 30 years in politics, this was the first formal address given by Pauline Hanson. Now, this speech, it wasn't really that surprising, right? It was anti-immigration, anti-multiculturalism, anti-trans, climate change is a hoax, and everything in between, and not much policy detail.
I think what mattered most was the setting.
Mm.
So Pauline Hanson said pretty much all of these things before. There might be a bit here or there, but what we hadn't seen before really was all of this in one place and in such an esteemed place. So there was that, I think, that moment where you see her at the lectern of the press club where you go, okay, something has clearly shifted here.
Mm.
She actually spoke for quite a long time, longer than the allotted time, and then ends up taking questions from the floor. Those exchanges, some of them were quite uncomfortable, quite terse, quite combative, in a way you don't normally see in that environment.
I've never seen a person that's at such a trashy journalist. Look, I can understand your question. You're going to be without a job. So anyway, I can understand that.
And I think that just kind of threw into sharp relief that we were watching a bit of a sea change.
Yeah, it was pretty stark. I mean, she was saying that multiculturalism is a complete failure and Australia should be a monoculture. I mean, how does that land, do you think, among the electorate? How do you rate her performance on a political level?
Well, the only way of determining how her performance is going on a political level is the polling at the moment, and it seems to be going very
yes.
well. I mean, we'll see whether it evolves in a different way after this. I don't think it necessarily will.
Mm.
But It's interesting. I mean, you know, you pull out those phrases and they sound sort of stark when you say it. But actually, when I heard that, my first thought was, well, this is pretty much what John Howard was saying. I don't know if he used the word monoculturalism or a monoculture, but he did say we are a multiracial nation, and he did take a stand against multiculturalism, and he abolished the Department for Multicultural Affairs. I think he renamed it the Department for Citizenship or something like that. So we've seen these moves before. This is really just an if it's an evolution at all, it's just that it puts it in sort of bolder terms or plainer terms. But it's very much in line with the kind of thing she's been saying. Now, the question is, how will that land? Here I would just caution people against drawing simple conclusions based on the idea that, you know, Australia is a multicultural nation and it has huge amounts of immigration in its population, so over years and years and years. So what I mean by that is that famous stat that gets dragged out all the time, that 50% of Australians are either born overseas or have a parent who was born overseas and so on. That doesn't mean that they won't vote for someone who's taking a stand against multiculturalism. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they don't like multiculturalism or anything like that. It just may not be a determining factor in how they assess a proposition like One Nation. So these things can land in all sorts of unpredictable ways. We are walking through a hall of mirrors now, and it's just all reflections and jumping at shadows and all sorts of things. So we don't really know, but I think easy conclusions like, well, this can't work in a multicultural electorate are things that we have to resist. I think we saw how badly those sort of presumptions or assumptions can run aground in the United States.
All right, well, let's turn now, Waleed, to your thesis, which of course is that One Nation can win the federal election. Of course, a slight chance, but an increasing chance, as you say. Now, there is no denying, is there, at this point, that One Nation is attracting voters that it did not attract in the past.
Yeah, so that's the key point. I'm not saying this based on the fact that, wow, it's polling quite high numbers now and it's gone past the coalition and then more recently it's gone past Labor in the polls. The thing that's happened in Australian politics, especially, it was really stark at the 25 election, was this almost, it seemed, irreconcilable divide between city and country. And so what that meant was that as the coalition kept getting banished from the cities and confined to the countries via the National Party and then some kind of mostly rural Liberal members, there was no prospect that the coalition could form government, because you can't form government in Australia without the cities. And so I'd been working on the theory that as long as One Nation, as long as its surge was basically claiming rural voters, then it could surge really as much as it liked. It was never going to be a threat for government. What happened in the past couple of weeks is not that the number of total votes kept going up or total support kept going up. It's that the demographics started to broaden. So this is what we saw in a Resolve poll, actually, that had One Nation in second place behind Labor. So it wasn't having it in first place, but it was starting to show that it's picking up city voters, tertiary educated voters, voters of higher income, and, you know, perhaps tellingly as well, that the majority of its support, by a small amount, but a majority nonetheless, is coming from women. So that's a broad demographic. And the point is, that's an election-winning demographic. If One Nation starts to become a party that has a realistic chance of picking up some city seats, then there is no reason that it can't form government. It really just becomes a question of extent. Can it get far enough into these demographics? Can it get far enough into the cities by the time the next election rolls around for it to be in that sort of a position?
And you compare this to the rise of Donald Trump. Now, worth noting, before he was first elected in 2016, his opponent, Hillary Clinton, well, she was really writing him off, and, of course, some of his supporters. Now, Anthony Albanese, he's not doing that.
People are under pressure. We understand that. It's easy to identify grievance. The issue is providing solutions.
Anthony Albanese's handling of One Nation is going to be really interesting to watch, and it will be an interesting experiment. The thing to bear in mind is we've seen movements like this now really all around the Western democratic world. Whether you want to call them far right or populist right or whatever term you want to use, they are now the most popular parties in, well, they've won in the US. They're the most popular parties now in the UK, in France, in Germany. They hold power in Italy. They got the highest vote in parliamentary elections in Austria. I guess the thing I would say is, as you scan the globe and see the fate of these sorts of movements, I can't think of a single society that is comparable to ours where this has actually been stopped. Mm. I can't think of one where there was some lever to pull that stopped it in its tracks. The thing that seems to stop it, actually, is that it gets power. So when Donald Trump becomes the president, then he becomes dramatically less popular. This is best understood not as a movement that is based on a package of policies that happen to be popular, although that is part of it. It's overwhelmingly a movement based on a mood, based on a posture, based on a rejection, based on a coalition of dissent. And the thing about that is that makes it an insurgent that is really storming the barricades of the establishment. And I don't know that in the end there's going to be that much that the Albanese government can really do to halt this.
Yeah, because there's a growing distrust here in Australia and, as you say, all around the world in the establishment, in the system, because people feel like the system is not working for them. They're worse off. They're not doing very well. So does Pauline Hanson actually have to give these voters an alternative in policy, or really does she just have to understand what they're going through and bring out this politics of dissent?
I mean, it might be that all she needs to do is embody a certain attitude, embody a certain posture. There's something there about authenticity and style and posture over content. So once you're in that phase, then you can actually kind of get away either without policy detail or with policy detail that doesn't necessarily withstand conventional scrutiny. And the reason is it's not playing a conventional game. Mm. So there's a kind of assumption that's pervading at least some political observers at the moment that this will all have to run aground once One Nation receives the kind of scrutiny it's never received before and when it starts to have scrutiny put on its policies. Well, yes, maybe. But that's applying the kind of logic that normally applies to conventional establishment political parties. And if that's not what you're looking at here, if you're looking at an insurgency, then none of that matters.
And by the way, like Nigel Farage in the UK, Pauline Hanson has some pretty wealthy backers, doesn't she? The mining magnate Gina Rinehart, she's given her $1 million plane. She's raised millions of dollars in donations from her Fire the Liar campaign. It's important to have a hefty war chest, isn't it? Very important.
Yeah, well, that definitely helps. But what's interesting about all of those elements is imagine those things in the hands of any other political party. Imagine Anthony Albanese or Angus Taylor being gifted, not personally, but to their party, a private jet from a billionaire. It would be a scandal. They'd never really be able to live it down. In the case of Pauline Hanson, much like in the case of Donald Trump, those sorts of things that would ordinarily be scandals, she can just brush off. I mean, her response was, it's a sexy plane and it doesn't cost the taxpayers anything. And then that's it. Play on, right? I think these sorts of things underscore just how different the rules are that she's playing by.
All right. Well, Waleed, as you note, yes, Pauline Hanson is playing a very different political game with a completely different set of rules. So I guess the real question is, how do the major parties actually address this? How do they attract people who think the system is completely broken? It's pretty difficult.
It's very difficult. And one of the reasons it's difficult is I think there are a lot of people who will jump to One Nation because they've called time on the system. And what that means is they're not any longer listening to it. Mm. And when that happens, it doesn't actually matter what Labor has to say, and it doesn't actually matter what the coalition has to say.
And on the question of a Prime Minister Pauline Hanson, well, you know, it's a pretty long shot still. Sure, she'd need to win 75 seats to form a majority government, but we shouldn't be writing her off, I guess, is your message.
I mean, I do think it's unlikely only because 75 is a lot. But even imagine the scenario where Labor squeaks home, and this was the scenario that was published in the Financial Review poll maybe a month ago, Labor gets 76 seats and One Nation ends up on 50-something. At that point, it becomes the official opposition. And I think that changes the whole political conversation as well. And so it then becomes not just about this election, it becomes about the next one and so on and so forth. Honestly, the number of things that could intervene here. I mean, this is anybody's guess, honestly, but it has to be taken seriously. And I think you're seeing that the government and the opposition, but especially the government, are taking it incredibly seriously.
Waleed Ali is the co-host of The Minefield on ABC Radio National, a columnist, author, and a lecturer in politics at Monash University. This episode was produced by Bridget Fitzgerald. Audio production by Sam Dunn. Our supervising producer is David Coney. I'm Sam Hawley. ABC News Daily will be back again on Monday. Thanks for listening.